Welcome to Relative Paths. We are a podcast about web development, web design, and that sort of thing. I am your host, Mark Phoenix, and your other host is Ben Hutchings.
Hello.
So this week we are talking about a subject which has raised not some little controversy, if that's a grammatically correct statement, particularly on the sort of echo chamber of Twitter, but it's the question of whether designers should code. We kind of visited this topic from the other direction back in episode 13, wasn't it? So what kind of input developers need to have in design, but we're looking at it from the other, slightly more controversial angle. And to help us go through this, we are joined by Ben Brignall. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. Thanks for bearing with us. We've Skyped down today. So we've kind of spent quite about half an hour or an hour kind of running around, scratching our heads, getting yogurt pots and string.
Bit of a nightmare. We're currently doing it through, Ben's listening to us through FaceTime audio and we're recording ourselves. He's recording himself. I hope you are, aren't you, Ben?
And I've just eaten two yogurts.
Excellent.
For no reason.
You have.
More yogurt pots. So that's good.
Yes, exactly.
Before we start, could you tell us a little bit about what your present role in the web is?
I'm basically a designer, but that would be, currently that would be something that kind of comes under the umbrella of a UX designer, I guess. But I sort of span between a bit of design, development, creative direction. But I like to refer to myself as a designer, if I can. Because I kind of think that's what it is, and it's the easiest thing. But it doesn't really help when you're trying to get work if you just advertise yourself as just a designer, because nobody really gets that.
Okay, so that's what you're doing now. Could you give us some idea about how you got started out in the web?
Yes. I started in desktop publishing, and I did a lot of work in the kind of financial sector, if that's a thing, doing kind of financial reports in the 90s. And then that evolved into electronic publishing, and because the nature of the content was time sensitive, it was about stocks and shares and things. So then that very quickly adopted web technology. And then I, dabbled in CSS. I was building a kind of a website to sell records for myself. And I sort of built my own website using CSS, and it was in XHTML, and it was the sort of that sort of phase of when that became a thing. And then that's just gradually evolved over the years. And I've been, interaction designer, UX designer, creative director. And now, I'm kind of, I've been backed into, I've worked for a couple of startups and a couple of larger organizations, and sort of been toing and froing between freelancing and having a proper job. But now I've been freelancing again for about a year. And I'm currently working in audio, doing a lot of stuff with podcasts and content providers who use audio. And I guess I'm also working on a feature. Well, it's an idea I've got in my head where you can actually skip when somebody's rambling on about themselves at the beginning of a podcast. Kind of skip the first 5 minutes of
We've already got that feature,
like,
by the way.
Click. Because nobody's interested in you. It's kind of a broad spectrum of things, which I kind of have always called design, I guess.
Okay. That would be a useful feature to have in everyday conversations if I could kind of have my brain retrofitted. that would be kind of useful. So you've got your foot in kind of both camps in a way, in the design camp and the development camp to a certain degree. But you said you kind of consider yourself to be more of a designer on the UX side of things now then.
Yeah, a designer, I guess.
Excellent. So our topic then, designers should or shouldn't code. I was searching around to try and find where the debate began, or where kind of like the sort of who lit the touch paper initially. And there was a tweet by Elliot Stocks back in 2010 where he said this: honestly, I'm shocked that in 2010 I'm still coming across, in quotes, web designers who can't code their own designs. No excuse.
Ooh.
So how do we feel as a gut reaction to that? Because it's a pretty inflammatory statement. I mean, how do we feel about that? Just what's our first reaction?
Yeah, I mean, my reaction to things like that is it's kind of, I mean, I don't really know if this is where it originated from. It sounds like something like this, but yeah, it's the, you know, it's quite a big thing to say in one tweet, and that tweet's clearly designed to ruffle some feathers. And also, I don't think it represents what it means to actually code. You know, when you think about what a designer would be using code for, a designer who codes their own designs, you know, doesn't really sound like the kind of thing that would be needed.
Mm. Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Like you said, I think it was designed to sort of ruffle feathers. And if you read any articles on this issue, when the writer kind of, you know, inflammatory or not, puts their view, if you kind of scroll down to the bottom half of the internet, which should never be done, but if you must kind of go to the Mordor of the web, then things kind of turn into a bit of a scrap.
A bun fight
pretty quickly. But what I thought would be quite interesting is just to kind of break down the question a little bit, because you already mentioned you're a designer, but that takes in a number of different aspects in terms of what you're doing. Do you think that term, designers, in terms of designers, shouldn't care? Do you think that's a bit too vague?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't really know why it needs to be specific, because I think each project and the thing that you work on is different. But going back to that kind of original tweet where he said designers who can't code their own designs, I see the design kind of code thing about working as a team. Design isn't a handover process. So that still implies that you kind of hand over something you've built, whereas the use of code is... It's, you know, whether you use it or not, it's about picking the most appropriate tool for the job. So if you're working in the web, just like if you're working in print, you understand, you know, trapping and leading and overprint and imposition and all those kind of things. It's about understanding the medium that you're using. You don't have to necessarily use code, but, you know, I think it's an appropriate tool for the job, especially with like responsive design and prototyping ideas.
So... In terms of the code then, I mean, again, designers should code. I mean, again, code is a bit of a broad term because you wonder what he means, whether he's talking about HTML and CSS or JavaScript or PHP. I mean, I guess back in 2010, people were probably more thinking in terms of HTML and CSS, weren't they?
There's already a lot of designers using Flash as well, which probably, I don't know.
I forgot that existed.
It seems so long ago now.
Yeah.
But, that was probably a big problem.
Learning ActionScript.
I think the biggest thing is the should, you know. I favour designers who code, and I could be just because that is part of the process that I use with the teams I work with, building style guides, prototyping, and that kind of thing. But it's, you know, it's more about picking the right tools for your process. So should you? Yeah, that's the kind of issue, I think.
Do you think, you said that you don't necessarily see a need to... describe a designer as anything more kind of accurate or drilled down than a designer. But if you were employing someone who was a designer, but they weren't able to do any sort of coding, I mean, I think in a minute we'll probably talk about the kind of things that a designer might be doing in terms of some sort of prototyping, whether it's in or out the browser. But if you had a designer that came to you that didn't have any of that kind of knowledge, would you just incorporate them into the team, kind of using them as an asset, just doing what they're capable of, and then find someone else to take up the slack, as it were?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that I'm not working just on the web, so I'm working on some products that are on Android, iOS and the web.
Yep.
So there are bits of those kind of things that don't necessarily need somebody who codes. But yeah, I don't really see many parts of the processes that I use where somebody would benefit if they didn't have a basic understanding of maybe even CSS.
Right. Okay. So that kind of fairly neatly takes us into the next questions or things we were going to talk about, which was what code should designers be learning? I mean, I know we don't want to use the word should here, but if they're going to maybe... I don't know if it's right to say make themselves a little bit more acceptable to certain teams in the current kind of work environment, what might be useful? So you've just mentioned CSS. What else might your designers that you employ or yourself be expected to do?
I think code is like a tool. So I don't think there are any hard and fast rules. But obviously, if you're thinking about designing for the web, then obviously HTML, CSS, and some jQuery or JavaScript is vital, really. But again, I don't think that should be necessarily be production code. We often, historically, a designer would work on a Photoshop document and hand that over to the developer, and that would get built. And then those Photoshop documents just get thrown away. Like, nobody cares what happens to them. But for some reason, when you prototyping code, it feels like there's often like the culture or thinking that we need to use this as production code. Whereas, you know, I see a designer's prototype is often, it can be a throwaway thing.
Okay.
So, you might actually create something that you just quickly test and think, oh, that's a stupid idea. and a developer never sees it. And I don't, that kind of comes into the debate a little bit, that designers are perceived to have to produce production code. You know, the code can be really dirty and horrible and quick, but it's amazing. You know, you do a lot more in kind of 2 or 3 hours than you can do in the same amount of time using Photoshop or something like that.
Yeah.
And then there's research is a huge part of design, which people often think, well, you know, why does code come into that? But, you know, if you're doing research and you understand a little bit of MySQL or, you can make a web scraper or something, then obtaining and analyzing data is a lot more it's a lot more helpful if you can understand some basic kind of coding principles. And also, when you are prototyping and you can import some JSON and actually work with live data. A lot of designers talk about, you know, not using lorem ipsum or dummy text, but if you're creating a kind of HTML prototype of a website, you know, redesigning a website, for example, you know, you can import the existing content and look at your designs without involving any developers very quickly, and, you know, test those with some people.
Yeah, actually, it's much better testing with real content, isn't it? Because lorem ipsum is, even though it's supposed to represent the idea of a sort of standard flowing and sized text and might wrap realistically and things like that, using real data. So there are times when I've worked on a design and found out that when it comes to production, like an excerpt from something is actually 2 paragraphs long and not one single line. And I've been building the thing to handle one single line or something like that. And actually the client wants to put in 2 paragraphs of data in someone's profile bio or something like that. So working with real life data, I can see the advantage of that. And not having to involve some kind of DBA to actually provide you with some raw sockets connection to a database. Just being able to pull some of it out yourself might be useful.
Yes, absolutely. And also, you know, just hacking around with an existing page with developer tools. Often you're iterating on an existing design and you can just quickly try out some ideas quite quickly.
So that, So if then you do have a designer or you're potentially working with a designer who can't do any of those things, or maybe who refuses, who maybe kind of silos himself in just design, just the principles, and doesn't want to get involved in the coding aspect at all, I mean, would that be somebody that just wouldn't suit to be used on a project? Or, I mean, in practical terms, how would that affect a project, or how would that affect working with developers, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that seems like quite a strange scenario. I've never really encountered anyone that was, you know, refusing to learn something. But they, I don't really see how someone would be part of a web team who would, you know, I've hired people who have got basic understanding of coding or none, but I wouldn't hire someone who would have an unwillingness to learn something new.
Yeah, that's interesting.
That could be anything, you know, a new version of a design tool or something else.
I've come across in studios I've worked in, I've come across what I would kind of term old school, fairly old school kind of print designers that just brush off the, oh, that's just that webby stuff. And they want to be able to give you an Illustrator layout of something for a logo or for some layouts for some web pages. And when it comes to doing things like responsive views, they want to just do flat Illustrator layouts and provide maybe, well, how many do you want? You want a mobile view, you want a tablet view, and you want a desktop view. And when you then explain, well, really,
what mobile view, what size tablet view. You know, we're talking about the principles of how this should work in a responsive manner. It kind of, I think it becomes a bit upsetting for someone who isn't willing to adapt or accept that they might have to start thinking about new ways of doing this. But maybe it's, I don't want to be ageist, but it often has been older developers, you know, who have been maybe doing print for 25 years.
So how does that work out then? So if you're in a project with a person like that, what happens?
Well, for me, it means that I have to just constantly go back to them saying, so here's a layout or here's a mock-up with your proposed design and look how it collapses now when you do this. Oh yeah, okay, well, I'll do you a layout for the 732 pixel size. It's like, no. So it takes a little while. But with you, Ben, you're employing people for a specific need or for a specific set of needs for your business or your project. And you wouldn't be looking for someone who didn't want to learn.
Yeah.
And
we, you know, things change quickly and we don't know what new things we need to learn in a few months. So
yeah,
there might be a new tool that helps with all this. You know, we don't know. And it's just about picking up all those things and as you go along. And, you know, again, picking the right tools for the job as you tackle each task. And a lot of this kind of is around principles and not rules. So you kind of have a discussion with the developer. Neither of you might be doing any code, but you might be making coding decisions on a whiteboard or explaining how a layout would reflow in a responsive design, which you can do a lot, have those kind of conversations up front without actually even having to build a prototype sometimes. Again, it depends on the things that you're doing. But a lot of those things can be discussions and not actually hands-on kind of stuff.
Mm. It's interesting. You mentioned earlier that you didn't see design as kind of a handover process. There's a bit of, not exactly a blur, but there's kind of almost like maybe a bit in a relay race where both people are running at the same time to hand over the baton. Is there a point where a handover takes place, or do you want designers who can be involved in putting something to production, like right up until the end when the developers are kind of really going at something?
Well, I think sometimes, I mean, a handover process, as I see it, is a designer designs a thing, everyone signs it off, and it gets built, which that kind of process doesn't really work
anymore, no.
So, yeah, it becomes very blurry where that process ends and begins and parts of the process start and finish. So it's more about kind of deciding what things are going to get released or what state they're going to be released in. Kind of I don't really like minimum viable products, but, you know, you agree on a bunch of stuff that you're going to ship at the next release. And the designers and developers will be working together, hand in hand, up until the point of release. And sometimes, you know, you realise that an icon doesn't work so well, a certain size or something. And, you know, on the last day, the designer will be, you know, just working on that in Illustrator or something. And that's kind of right up until the end. So I don't see, because the design is something that's iterated on and is never really finished until the world ends sometime in the future.
you don't really know
the level of fidelity or the kind of validity of something that you're building until it's actually out in the wild and people actually using it. So this handover kind of thinking is a bit broken, I think, because the nature of Agile and Scrum and all different kind of web processes that people may or may not use are kind of, over a period of time, doing lots of tweaks and hacks and polishing.
So this might be quite interesting for a discussion, wondering how freelancers can adopt to stop some of these suggestions and adapt their way of working, maybe, because for a lot of freelancers, like myself, I don't do any design. Maybe this discussion should developers design? But, I don't think I have the ability, so I try and avoid it. When I say design, I mean traditional design, actually laying out something that looks good on the page. So I have to work along with other designers, and they're often other freelancers. And I suppose the way of the old idea of having maybe getting a designer, a freelance designer, to send me some mock-ups. I build them, I then deliver them to the client, and the client then pays me and I pay the designer. That just doesn't work anymore, does it? So even freelancers need to be planning for ongoing meetings as they throughout the process, so that what is being built can go back to the designer to say, is this how you saw it?
I mean, it's not easy. I mean, I've worked in large organizations where there's been, you know, 40, 45 developers, and, you know, 90% of your time is spent kind of in rather dull, long meetings, just on doing workshops and things, just trying to get people thinking that this is the right way to be doing it. So you only spend about 10% of your time actually designing something. So there's this kind of like cultural legacy thinking that certain organizations have, but that's hard if you're a freelancer, because you might only work somewhere for 2 weeks and be asked to design or build a thing, and you just have to do the best you can in that time. It's very easy to say this is how you should do something or this is how you shouldn't, but in reality, when you're freelancing, you're never in the same company or organization, or even working for the same period of time on each different project.
Does that happen with you, Ben? So you're describing kind of a bit more of a sort of joined up approach to design and development, where kind of you're developing with the designer. Do you find that happens practically, or is it a bit more of the old school, here's the design, code it? So do you find yourself actually making what would be considered to be design decisions?
I find that, but it needs changing. I think it's still quite hard maybe to convince the client that they don't need, that we're not going to work in the old school way of doing things. And even myself, I have to remember that I'm not just maybe paying someone for a design and then, you know, like going online and buying a design for a website, buying some layouts and then me coding them up and delivering them. It's not working. So I have to sort of force myself to not to just kind of take over effectively after I've got the design and start making decisions which are wrong, because I'm not really qualified to make them, and the design falls apart more and more and more the longer I'm left with it. It does, and I can see why it's very important to have the person who maybe originally developed, or the team that originally developed the concepts, to be involved right throughout it, so they can keep reining you in. I don't know whether you've got different types of designers, developers. You've got some developers who've got a very good eye, and they may have a design background, and that's going to help a lot. But for me, I tend to start to lose sight of how things look and how they operate, the kind of UX aspects, and start to think more technically about page load, page speed and things like that, and exactly how I'm going to minify these or concatenate these files. And I go off on one and I end up delivering something that hopefully loads super quick and does very few requests, but actually starts to look a bit terrible.
Interesting, because we had a discussion with Malcolm Coombs a while ago,
yeah,
who you've worked with. And I think one of the things that came across there is that sometimes the developer can hamper the process, because a designer could suggest something and the developer's like, that's not going to work. And that can sometimes sort of block things up. But over to you, Ben. When, I know we're not thinking of a handoff in the traditional sense, but when a developer is working on a piece of design, how does it work if the developer kind of starts making design decisions and starts kind of moving things around, let's say? How do you find as a designer? Do you need to kind of go and sort of claw that back a little bit, or is that, again, just part of the continuing iteration process? I mean, what I'm saying,
that's kind of part of the process. I mean, no one person really sits on their own and makes decisions and finishes something and hands it over to somebody else. So a designer would work with a developer, and they would sit down in front of the screen with a prototype or the actual product in a browser, resize it, try it on different devices, and make those decisions together. And it's just a discussion rather than, you know, we need lots of documentation to decide what this paragraph does on these devices. You know, it's about actually trying it on real devices. And going back to what Ben said about performance and that kind of thing, there's a lot of designs that could be really terrible when it comes to performance. So a design that had, I don't know, six different web font weights or something.
Yeah.
So they're the things that's where a designer and developer kind of overlap on those kind of decisions. And often the counter argument for this whole, fairly boring topic of should designers code is, should developers design? And I think, well, yes, I think they should, because that doesn't mean that a developer would finish, produce highly polished design concepts, visual design concepts. But at the same time, when a designer codes, it doesn't mean that they're going to be shipping production code that's amazing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, I see. So it can mean the same in reverse. It just makes it easier for the collaboration if a developer maybe understands some design concepts.
Yeah,
because it's like what you said at the beginning about working in print and having a designer understanding the technical aspects of print. I guess if somebody had no idea how that worked and wanted to design for print, then that would be, they wouldn't produce particularly useful designs, I guess.
Yes. I mean, I've seen some things that were created by a web designer for print, and it was literally unprintable. It had to be redone. It didn't have any bleed. The images were low resolution. The page size was wrong, and pagination didn't work, and those kind of things. And if you flip that around, a print designer working for the web, it's you can come across the same kind of huge fundamental problems. So I think designers and developers should work together closely, just like a designer would work with a guy on the print floor years ago, where you'd actually print something, look at the color that's coming out, and think, that looks nothing like my screen, what was I thinking?
Right.
It's sort of multidisciplinary teams. We're all sort of, everyone works on their own bit, but no one person is making all the decisions in a team, I guess.
That is interesting. In response to this question of whether designers should code, some people have said, well, you don't ask project managers to code, or you don't ask stakeholders to code. Do you think that is a bit of a red herring, that argument?
I really understand why these arguments come up. I think people should just use the right tools for the job. I've worked with product managers, stakeholders who code. Also, I think developers should be stakeholders in a project. Designers should be stakeholders in a project. So they're two stakeholders that probably have got some coding skills. But what a product manager is and a designer are the roles are quite blurred now. Product manager and a designer in this sort of agile world are in some ways the same thing. When you think about how you're managing the expectations of the team and working together and making design decisions on a whiteboard and in a prototype, that's kind of what a product manager and a designer do. And I've seen a few designers who've, user experience designers who've become product managers, and a lot of product managers are involved in user testing and prototyping. So I think, again, things are very blurry, but that's the nature of the web. It's not really one thing. Otherwise, we just have kind of websites out of the box.
Yeah. So that kind of brings us on to the idea of unicorns. Have you ever met someone who's called themselves a unicorn, Ben? In terms of their ability?
Yeah. I've met a lot of people who've been called unicorns, and I've never really
what's your thoughts
kept
on it?
In touch with them.
Do you use your real life podcast skipping the first 10 minutes of what they're saying in?
I think a lot of these sort of I don't know why I said again, because I don't think I've said it before. A lot of these kind of names and silos and job titles and roles and things kind of come out of sort of recruitment and having to hire someone for a specific job, and that's tends to only be that one project. And then you can't necessarily hire somebody who is a prototyper or a designer or a very specific piece of project, and also you wouldn't have kind of 30 people all working on little different bits, one person doing code, one person doing design, one person doing the style guide, one person doing the color palette or something. So, yeah, I don't really know where I'm going with this, but I really think these sort of names come out of the overall principle that there isn't really a job title for this kind of work.
It's yeah.
kind of just designing bits of the web and working in a team, I guess.
So I suppose that if people are, if someone is looking for work, or that they maybe have just left some sort of full-time education, and they're looking at all these job listings and postings and thinking, right, so effectively I need to be able to do 45 different things to get most of these jobs, because most of the listings just list everything. They want, yeah. And they're asking for unicorns, aren't they? So people are thinking, oh, well, I need to be one. So they're starting to try and learn a bit of everything. Do you have any thoughts on doing that instead of specialising?
I think a generalist is what, you know, somebody who's typically a hybrid designer, developer, or a generalist is likely what is needed in most cases when actually building products for the web. But I think these sort of roles and a lot of these sort of job descriptions that you see out there, they've kind of got the reverse effect in that they actually turn away good designers who are probably willing to learn.
Yeah.
Because, you know, all the things I've learned, I've never really, you know, the first website I built was when I realized I needed a website.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't like I learned how to build a website and then I built one. It kind of, that's kind of what design is, solving problems that come up, and sometimes that's learning a new thing.
So when recruiters ask for unicorns, what actually happens then? If, you know, because you mentioned that it already turns away, it might turn away a good designer, but do the recruiters ever get that? Do they ever get what they want, or is it there somebody who's blagging a little bit, and do the recruiters kind of, do they learn when people start responding to the adverts and sort of saying, this isn't possible what you're asking for? I mean,
you are asking Ben to give an opinion on recruiters here, and having followed his Twitter feed for a few years now, I don't think he's too keen on recruitment agencies.
Okay, I thought Ben was going to start singing some love songs about recruiters.
No, death hate songs.
Oh no, I think recruiters just kind of herd up people and chuck them at companies who interview them, and it just, whatever comes up at the interview is what matters.
Okay, that was very restrained. Well,
I was expecting some more. I was expecting some more rage.
Yeah, in
a few. I've just jabbed a pen into my leg.
We'll send some medical attention your way. So back to talking about specialization. I remember reading somewhere that I can't remember who it was, but they were suggesting that people's knowledge should be kind of T-shaped. As in, they should have a good awareness of most things across the web, in terms of design, development, and that sort of thing, but should have like in-depth knowledge of one particular area. I mean, do you think that's a useful idea? Or as you said, is a generalist usually the most useful person?
Yeah, I mean, any knowledge is very useful. I'm not too sure exactly what that principle refers to when it talks about like one kind of area of knowledge. I mean, the overall principle of design and composition and layout, if you've got that in your head, that's really useful. I don't really know where I'm going with this.
That's okay. It was a little bit of a vague question. I think what it was is, I was asking whether about specialization, whether that's a dangerous thing to do in today's climate, because as we've already mentioned, a lot of recruiters are asking for unicorns. Sorry, in North Korea maybe they are, but a lot of recruiters are asking for unicorns. So there is this idea that people should be able to do everything. But do you think does a developer or designer work against their own interests if they specialize very heavily in one area?
I love a man in unicorn. Sorry. But people specialised in Flash, and that's something that's kind of not necessarily gone, but it's not really around anymore. So I think specialising in any one thing is very useful in channeling your expertise. But I would always be reluctant to think that was my one thing I only ever did, which is what specialising seems to refer to. And something like user experience, some people say I specialize in user experience, but when you break that down, there's research, there's prototyping, there's validating ideas, there's business analysis, and all those things are quite specialist things. So when someone talks about themselves as I specialize as a user experience designer, you know, there's things within that that aren't, you know, really that become a bit vague as to what their specialism is. And people call, you know, generalists often refer to user experience as just being good design. But then how do you know that design is good? How do you measure that the design is appropriate or effective? And there's all those kind of components of user experience design and development that kind of answer those questions.
Interesting. So I guess there is a bit of, there's kind of almost seems to be a little bit of a to and fro between being a generalist and sort of being and specialising, I guess. But you mentioned like specialist and flash. I guess maybe if somebody that does that is kind of like the opposite of unicorn, maybe a web panda, if they kind of specialise in one area too much and then their area goes away, then I guess they're in some difficulty, aren't they?
I mean, in that you get these sort of things naturally develop in teams. So I think the problem with specialism is how do you hire someone who's very specialist in a new innovative thing that's not been done before, which is ideally what you're trying to do whenever you build anything. But within a team, you get those kind of more brick-like people who focus on, in 90% of their time, on one thing like development or prototyping or visual design. And then there's kind of like the mortar-like people who sit within those and kind of hold everything together. And each individual is really important, but they've all got different roles with levels of specialism that are that channel that particular product that you're building on.
Good analogy.
That's a good analogy. That's a good analogy to kind of begin our wrapping up then. So we've already discussed how this relates to, or how this could potentially relate to freelancers. But again, just to recap and wrap up, how would this, I mean, what does a freelancer take away from this discussion and this sort of debate, do you think?
Well, so by a freelancer, you mean somebody who kind of, like, works from home, kind of building stuff.
Freelancers.
So you mean people? I mean, I think you're referring to what you are going to be, Mark, and what I am at the moment is that we can't necessarily turn in our chair and say to someone, "Can you just check this out for me?" Because we're not working with anyone. So when we're collaborating with people on the very best project, it might be just two other individuals. You know, never a team of 30. Or 40, unless we're actually, the only time I've worked with large teams is going in to businesses and maybe doing a couple of weeks of contracting with them. So technically that might be freelancing, but I tend to call that contracting. Are you a freelance person? You're self-employed?
Yes.
But you're contracting full-time at the moment, is that right?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, that changes from time to time, but obviously the freelance thing, you could be working in a huge team, you could be working from home on a small piece of a project, or it depends. But I think to answer your question, I kind of think you're talking about someone more like yourself who, you need to build a website for a small company or something, or small to medium sized company, and there might be a developer or a designer or product manager somewhere, but not in the same room as you.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, it's difficult because it can, even now, I've worked quite closely with developers, but those days where I've worked from home for whatever reason, I find it really stressful, because just kind of pointing at something on a whiteboard or going, oh, it should be a bit more like this swooshy sound or something.
Yeah.
That turns into sort of 30 or 40 emails when you're not actually with somebody in a team.
Yes.
So I think to answer that question, how is this relevant to freelancers? It's difficult because often this is kind of cultural thinking around how the teams are built and set up and how who's been hired and who's been given this specific role and who's been doing this for 3.5 years and who's new. And it's about just trying to get the best from the team that you're working with. And it doesn't always mean that you can just follow these Twitter-like statements, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
Because this whole designer should code is, a statement that is irrelevant, really.
Okay. Wow. That summed it up, I think.
I think that summed it up, yeah. Okay, anything more to add, or should we wrap up there?
Yeah, I've got something I wanted to say about. Sorry, we record. Well, I've ruined it now.
No, you haven't.
we're gonna leave that bit in just to punish you.
Yeah, no. So I'm just want to say one thing about the kind of the processes around a designer who codes or of a developer who designs or working within a team. I think there's a bit of superiority around these sort of statements around I'm a designer who codes and blah blah blah. But when you are building a prototype, it's quite a linear process. So once you've kind of got a firm or general idea of what you want to build, there's not really kind of much flexibility around what you can do with that prototype other than just change kind of some colours and the width and layout. And whereas when you think of the visual design approach using something like Sketch or Illustrator, one thing I've never been able to do with code is you know, once you've got a general idea for a layout, let's say you're designing like a header or a sign-up module or something, in Sketch or Illustrator, you can duplicate 30 versions of that, try different font sizes, color combinations, variants of that one idea. And then you kind of realize there's only three of those are actually any good. And then you sort of fine tune it a bit more and end up with one design. Then you take that back into code. And I've never really found a way to do that in code. I find it quite a linear process. In some ways, it becomes quite difficult and restrictive. Yeah, sorry. Have you gone?
No. I was looking at Mark thinking Mark was going to talk.
And digesting.
I think Mark was looking at me.
But you're right. I think... Sorry, go on, Ben.
Yeah, and it's not just about the web. A lot of products are native mobile and web and different combinations of other bits and pieces. And I don't really know how you communicate something like a transition or the motion of an interaction without understanding some code. And you know, something like Framer.js is quite useful in helping you communicate that with an iOS or Android developer. It uses a bit of, you know, need a bit of JavaScript or CoffeeScript knowledge, but the kind of fine details in something like a transition can make or break a mobile app, I think.
Right.
I think that's probably a good place to wrap up, because I think this is a kind of subject we could talk about sort of all day.
Yeah.
But yeah, you've been very insightful. Thank you very much. We'll pause and have a jukebox now.
Right, so yeah, no, we're not doing a jukebox yet. We're going to do a tool star. And Ben, you have one for us. You've just mentioned Sketch, and I believe that is your tool star for this week.
It is Sketch.
It is Sketch. Tell us more about Sketch and why you love it.
I think Sketch has really solved a lot of the design process problems that have arisen around what we've been talking about, that there's no real way to design something without involving lots of people. And I don't think Sketch will ever solve that, and I don't think it should, but it really helps in that you can quite easily look at CSS snippets of a piece of visual design or create different artboards for different responsive sizes. And more importantly for me is working with native apps. It just makes it so easy when you can export to various resolutions and screen DPIs and things like that.
So how would you describe it? It's not like Photoshop then, but it's not necessarily like Illustrator. I mean, is it placing assets on screen to represent sort of wireframes, things like that? Because I've not used it.
Yeah. I mean, a bit more than that. I mean, yeah, it's a visual design application. It gives you a lot of flexibility over all kinds of things. You know, you can create style guides, you can create component libraries and within Sketch. So it helps your consistency across, it helps maintain consistency across several things that you're working on at the same time. It allows you to export to different sizes really easily. It's basically a vector design application.
Okay.
It's Mac only as far as I understand. Is that right?
I think so, yeah. Sorry.
I'm just going to go and sit in the corner then.
Just buy a Mac instead.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Can I have yours?
Yeah, no, you can't. We're currently using it to record this on.
But so the advantage of Sketch over maybe a more traditional tool like Photoshop or Illustrator, I mean, what is the advantage, do you think?
I think it's been designed specifically for web and mobile app design, whereas Illustrator and Photoshop, as much as I like them, they've kind of evolved over the years, they've evolved out of print and doing like photos. It's always really weird that kind of Photoshop was what you did your photos with, and then suddenly like people design websites in Photoshop. The problem with Photoshop is it's kind of restricted to one kind of size. I think that's changing now, whereas Sketch allows you to have several different artboard sizes, and you can work on three things at the same time and copy ideas into the sort of artboard area and sort of tinker around and iterate on designs that aren't kind of in your master files and things like that. So it's it's really powerful.
Okay, and any idea how much it is?
I think it's $99, something like that, or even cheaper. I don't know.
Okay, so sorry. It's accessible. No, it's fine, because things like, I'm just thinking that things like Creative Suite or buying, say, Photoshop on its own is really expensive. So it's good to know that it's actually a bit more achievable, maybe, especially for freelancers, as we do have many sitting at home freelancers in their underpants.
mental image.
who may worry about spending, you know, £500 on a software package.
Yeah, I mean, I still use Photoshop and Illustrator because I've always used them and I'm a lot quicker with them. And sometimes what I need to do isn't always possible in Sketch, or at least I don't know how to do it. I tend to, if I'm doing like logo or icon design or kind of like really finicky sort of stuff, or even illustration, I always just go straight to Illustrator for that sort of thing. But when it comes to web design and app design, it's something that took me a while to actually commit to using, because I would often bail out and use Illustrator when there was a deadline and I had to do something, just because it was the quickest way, but it wasn't the right way to do it. So I forced myself to use Sketch a couple of years ago, and you know, it took about 2 days or so to learn all the shortcuts and kind of get my head around it. But it's pretty powerful.
So worth making the switch then, you think, if, yeah.
Yes, I think for the majority of sort of visual design work, I think it's the right thing to use.
Excellent. I've just started getting my head around Photoshop and Illustrator. It'll break your heart to find out how much I can actually get it for, because my wife's a student and so she needs it, and she gets it on education pricing and it's pretty cheap. It's been interesting, because I think we did a show a little while ago where I was talking about designing in the browser, because that was what I was mostly doing.
Yeah.
And I was sort of said, I'll be interested to see how I view things when I get a tool like Photoshop, and I sort of just whacked a design together in Photoshop. Mm. I just thought, I understand why people use this kind of tool, because I always tended to be very biased towards designing in the browser. But then, like you said, I end up worrying about my naming schemes and my code, and worrying about writing the code properly and making sure it's dry and indenting it, and all these kind of like code concerns, which kind of distract a bit away from the design. But yeah, just thought I'd say that as an aside. Mm. So Sketch is our tool star.
Okay, thanks for that, Ben. That's good. So the last part of our show is the jukebox. So who's first today?
I think Ben better go first, hearing his track.
Yeah.
Okay.
What do you have for us, Ben?
It's a... Because you said it's electronic. It has to be electronic. Was that a rule? It should be electronic.
Well, you know, it should be electronic. Yeah, designers should listen to electronic.
So... This is a song called "Glass Jar" by Gang Gang Dance, and yeah, it sounds stupid. It looks like a really cool name, and then when you say it out loud, you sound like an idiot.
No, you don't sound like an idiot.
But I tend to put this on some or most mornings, because basically, if I make it through this track to the end without somebody disturbing me and walking over and asking me a question, I know it's probably going to be a good day. It's about 11 minutes long, I think.
So how's that worked out today?
I haven't put it on today. Sorry. shall I make up an answer for that?
Do you want to try it now and we'll just hang around for 11 minutes? Yeah.
No, that's fine. No, we don't make up answers for this show. It's all real.
This is the truth. But anyway, should we have a little listen?
Yeah, okay.
listened to your track, Ben, and I just thought it was I thought it was amazing. I think I actually had to pull over. I was in my car to stop and listen because I was a little bit afraid it was hypnotising me to do things.
You thought it was NLP, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it's a little bit like the kind of thing Darren Brown would sort of play to you before. Like he, I don't know, he convinces you to kind of clear up your bank accounts and kind of go and live in Mongolia or something like that. But anyway, so my track is a track called Awake to You by Taylor McFerrin, who is the son of Bobby McFerrin.
Wow.
And it's interesting. I think you've accused me of kind of having a bit of a medieval
medieval pirate folk.
Yeah.
I think it was.
It's either that or something that's a Boards of Canada sound alike. And so this week it's a Boards of Canada sound alike.
Okay.
My effort to kind of get our playlist to be pirate folk and Boards of Canada. But it's a really interesting track. It's got a very kind of hip-hoppy kind of sort of quite beaty sort of structure, and I think he uses the same kind of synths that Boards of Canada uses, but it's just a really nice beaty sort of hip-hoppy kind of it feels like a grown-up track. It feels like quite a mature track. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of it's difficult to describe, so
let's have a little listen then.
Yeah. I know what I mean when I say it's a grown-up track. Anyway, what was yours?
That was really good, by the way. I enjoyed listening to it.
mine is Through Clouds by Gold Panda. Have you heard of Gold Panda?
I like Gold Panda.
Yeah.
One of their tracks will be appearing again on the playlist under my jurisdiction.
You are constantly nicking my music and recycling it as your own. I like the fact that he got almost obsessed with Japan when he was younger, and I did too. I got so into it. Anything about Japan, the culture, the art, all the weapons.
Films.
Yeah, the films.
I was going to go for films. If you want to go
Probably something to do with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Or Hero Turtles, as we had in this country.
Don't watch the Michael Bay version.
No, okay, I won't. No, I didn't, and I won't.
Oh, don't.
But this this Gold Panda person, and I don't know what his real name is, actually, he was a bit obsessed with it, and then he went to Japan to do some kind of Japanese, Oriental, and African studies. And you can really tell, a lot of his music sounds very sort of nostalgic, and it's got a lot of samples in it that just for some reason sound Japanese. I'm not even sure they are, but it must be what he's picked up from spending time there and being a bit obsessed with it, really. It is sometimes very bleepy, ambient-y, but also beaty. So it pretty much fits.
Ticks all the boxes.
Ticks all the right boxes for our playlist. So here is Through Clouds. So what did you think of that, Ben?
With all sincerity, I thought it was amazing.
Good. So that is it. That's our jukebox. We've had a tool star. We've chatted about design.
I think we're done now, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
So thanks for joining us, Ben. If people were to follow you on social media or things like that, how would they do that? And do you have anything else, any projects or anything like that, that you'd like to make us and are billions of listeners aware of?
I am on Twitter. I use that sometimes. And I'm just Ben Brignall, which is my name. But I've also got a sort of side project, which is like a web comic that I've kind of tried to make like an accessible web comic for blind and visually impaired users to actually still be able to read or enjoy. And I'm using Jekyll and SVG and Markdown and making it overly complicated for myself, not for the user. But that's called Frisbee Fodder, and it's frisbeefodder.com. I've put 3 episodes out. I've written 60 episodes.
What?
Wow.
But I've not done them yet. I've done the next sort of few, and I'll just be sort of periodically uploading them. Originally I thought it'd be like kind of like a weekly thing, but reality is that life became a bit too busy. So
am I going to have to wait until episode 60 to find out who Meg is?
Ha. Good question. No, I think there's another 2 or 3 episodes and then you'll find, oh no, that's probably ruined it. Another couple of episodes.
You mean I can skip the next 2?
Yeah.
So just to make people aware of Frisbee Fodder spoilers.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm a reader. I didn't realise that I didn't know about the accessible
elements.
That's really interesting. I think Ben is self-editing
that. Yeah. Well, the accessibility side is something I'm exploring and trying to do properly. I've had a lot of help from the, I don't really know how you pronounce it, Ali, A11Y, accessibility Slack forum, Slack channel, have been really great and helpful in helping me kind of get that side of things together. But it's not perfect yet, but... it's kind of getting there because I still don't really know what I'm doing.
Best way of learning.
Yeah.
By the seat of your pants.
But yeah, they've been really helpful. And if you are into accessibility, which you should be, you should join the Slack group.
We'll put a link to that in our show notes as well as Frisbee Fodder as well.
Mm. Thank you.
Okay, so that's our show. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thank you for having me along.
You're most welcome. As always, this show will be up on our website, relativepath.uk, with a discussion thread. So if you would like to discuss this subject in a calm and sober way with no bun fighting, then feel free to join the discussion there. We are Relative Paths on Twitter. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher or SoundCloud. Reviews are always welcome. I think you told me off for being a bit too beggy for reviews. So if you want to leave a review, then go ahead. If you don't, then, whatever. We don't mind. But reviews are always welcome. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back in your ears in a couple of weeks' time.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.